The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's been reported for a while that Ted Kaufman, who briefly was a senator from Delaware and is a longtime Biden advisor, is the person who's leading the transition effort overall. And the most Lawfare relevant transition personnel figure is Avril Haines, who used to be the deputy national security advisor. There's been reporting that suggests that she's leading the Biden transition's foreign policy and national security team. And then this week, I would say the biggest transition-related story was a piece in Politico that described that Biden is a COVID task force as part of his transition team.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 9th, 2020. Well, that's it, folks. We have a president-elect, Joe Biden, if you hadn't emerged from your cave. And we have a president who is now officially a lame duck, although don't try to tell him that. So we are going to shift hard and talk about the transition, where Joe Biden goes from here. How do you transition from Donald Trump to a more normal presidency? And does the insurgency have last gasps? Joining me in the jungle studio, Scott Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, Jacob Schultz, and Susan Hennessy. We're going to go over it all. We are recording this on Friday afternoon, before actually any victory has been declared. It is clear that that is going to happen, but events that happen over the weekend or even Friday evening will postdate the recording of this podcast. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 9th. Trump is defeated. All right. So as I said in the introduction, we're actually recording this before it is officially true. If you're hearing this, it is because facts bore it out. Scott, get us started. The much vaunted litigation effort to prevent the counting of votes that were going to prevent Biden's election kind of didn't amount to very much. Bring us up to speed on where things are and why they didn't pan out more effectively for President Trump than they did.
Sure thing. Well, you know, the litigation effort isn't over yet, and I suspect we're going to see more threads of it moving forward, even though this count is completed. The number of lawsuits really hasn't changed that much in the last 24 hours for those who've been keeping up with our kind of series of podcasts here. There's a Supreme Court case relating to Pennsylvania, relating to ballots that arrived after Election Day as to whether they could be counted. Those are currently being segregated out. There is a lawsuit in Michigan, although I believe that one has been dismissed, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania as well, and in Nevada, seeking essentially to stop the counting of votes, usually on allegations that the right to observe the process isn't being adequately enforced, usually because people are being asked to stay more than 6 feet away from the people actively counting for COVID measures, at least in Pennsylvania. That's the argument that the state has put forward there. We see a litigation that's still ongoing, as far as I know, in Georgia. That is a similar kind of early vote issues in Pennsylvania as to whether certain ballots are being counted that arrived on time. I believe a trial level court did away with that matter as well on a basis of lack of evidence, but we're still waiting to hear. And in Nevada, there is this pending federal suit that alleging large-scale fraud, essentially, in Nevada, mail-in ballots on a scale of 10,000 is what's been advertised, although it's not clear to me that that appears to be going anywhere, in part for lack of evidence. I did see some chatter on Twitter about that potentially also having met a judicial end at this point, but I've not had a time to chase that down yet. So none of these have really manifested anything yet. The Supreme Court case is very well may go forward. It's very well Republicans are going to win in that case. There is this kind of prevailing theory that some of the conservative justices on the Supreme Court seem to have already bought into, that state legislatures really define the rules of elections within states, and that other institutions are handicapped, overriding or expanding upon them in ways that they find are contrary to legislative intent. You could argue, and certainly the Republican Party in Pennsylvania and now the Trump campaign have argued, that is what the state Supreme Court did in allowing them to count these votes for three extra days past Election Day. There's also arguments as to whether that's federally permissible. I don't think many people seriously doubt that it is, but you certainly hear that in kind of circles of the president's supporters arguing that Congress or the Constitution is required that they be counted by Election Day. In reality, that is almost certainly not the case. It is not a practice that's been abided by consistently, but they may lose there. But again, it seems very unlikely that that is the margin by which Pennsylvania is actually going to be decided. Instead, former Vice President Joe Biden seems well on his way at this point, as of Friday when we're recording, to have gotten to the point where he's going to have a very comfortable margin that's not going to be swingable by that number of voters, although we don't know for sure. Georgia, you could see it swinging a little bit more. There, the margin is really just a couple of thousand votes at this point. Some potential to go up, but not nearly as many outstanding votes still waiting to be counted there. So it's potential to swing Georgia, but Georgia doesn't swing the determination of who's president at this point. If Georgia and Pennsylvania and Nevada and Arizona are going towards Joe Biden, as is the current projection, then he has three different routes to 270. And President Trump would have to win on all three, Pennsylvania or Georgia or either Arizona, Nevada, and swing the outcome with a legal victory there to actually change who becomes president. That just seems like a very tall order. And none of the litigation they've brought forward so far seems anywhere close to on track to accomplishing that.
Susan, though President-elect, I suppose we should call him Biden, declared victory, it is pretty clear that Trump does not concede defeat. So you have this unusual situation in which a transition has to get going in the context of the sitting president not merely not having conceded, but actively seeking to undermine the integrity of the election. What's the right posture for the Biden campaign and for Joe Biden himself in that context? It's kind of a delicate situation.
Yeah, it's certainly a delicate situation, although I think one that the Biden campaign has handled pretty well, though not flawlessly. The Biden campaign has adopted a pretty clear line of saying that while the election is not yet concluded, while they are not actually declaring victory, they are highly confident that when all of the votes are counted, they will prevail. And so sort of being careful to not engage in, you know, you can't declare victory because we declare victory, and being really cautious in their language. Bob Bauer, a senior Biden campaign official, did sort of make an early comment that the press jumped on, saying we have won this election, I think intending to reflect that the votes had been cast, although they hadn't been tabulated. Since then, we've seen a lot of sort of care. I think there's sort of two challenges, two questions. So one is, how does the Biden campaign and now the Biden transition move into a formal transition period in an environment in which the president has not conceded? Now, there's no legal effect of Donald Trump conceding. The outgoing president doesn't have to concede. It's a tradition of the last 100 years. You know, that said, it does complicate things, because while there is a certain sort of automatic function of the certification of the election, typically we expect sort of the transition period to begin well in advance to that final certification, right? We expect sort of individuals inside the government to start talking to transition officials, start making plans, sharing information. It's especially important right now. We're in the middle of a really dangerous global pandemic, one that is actually getting worse, has not disappeared the day after the election, as Trump claimed it would. And so I think there's a real question at this point. If Trump really, really digs into this idea that he is not conceding, will he prevent individuals inside the White House who have been preparing for this transition from beginning to execute it? Will he issue an order to federal agencies effectively barring them from having communications with transition staff? How long is that really tenable? Or instead, is this going to be a lot of sort of rage tweeting by the president, lots of sort of incendiary rhetoric, but behind the scenes, you know, the White House staffers understand what's going on, federal agencies understand what's going on, and they will begin sort of preparing for this transition with or without the president's stamp of approval. There's a separate question, though, about how the Biden campaign deals with the ongoing sort of disinformation campaign. At this point, neither the lawsuits nor the sort of baseless claims of voter fraud are really about sort of trying to prevail and win Trump ultimately a second term. I don't think there's any reasonable person who believes that's the outcome. And I sort of suspect that Donald Trump himself recognizes that that's not what's going to happen. So instead, in a series of speeches, we've seen the president really attempt to delegitimize the U.S. election itself and to delegitimize sort of the faith and confidence in the process among his base and then sort of the very, very large number of voters who ultimately cast their ballots for him. That's really dangerous. One, sort of the whole name of the game in election security is not just ensuring that we in fact have free and fair elections, but also preserving public confidence in free and fair elections. How does the president-elect handle that when the sitting president is the source of the delegitimization effort? More acutely, although quite disturbingly, I think that we're in a real risk of this is a ripe moment for foreign disinformation campaigns to sort of come in and fan the flames to sort of incite divisions and in the most extreme case there's the possibility of violence. We've already seen Philadelphia law enforcement say that they believe that they have thwarted, I think, what's accurately described as a domestic terror plot. Armed individuals coming to the Philly vote counting location with some nefarious purpose. It's not entirely clear what that is. And we're seeing the rhetoric by the president, his family, and sort of the more right-wing cadre of his supporters growing increasingly violent, using the language of war, talking about going to battle. And sort of the pushback from that by establishment Republicans has ranged from kind of tepid and mealy-mouthed, you know, we've seen Mitt Romney and Patrick Toomey kind of say, you know, there's no evidence of fraud, and Ben Sasse, you know, but they're also kind of, you know, throwing lines in like, well, only lawful votes should be counted. And then we've seen individuals like Lindsey Graham, you know, sort of go on Fox News and suggest that that these claims aren't just valid, but actually should serve as the basis for the Pennsylvania legislature to decline to seat the electors and to substitute electors, really, really fanning the flames. And so this is a moment in which it doesn't appear that the establishment Republicans are sort of rushing in to be super responsible and save the day. That puts the Biden team in a really, really difficult position. We knew that Biden was going to have a really heavy lift on day one of attempting to repair some of the damage that Trump has done over the past 4 years. And I think we're already seeing like that challenge and sort of the difficulty of his position is on his doorstep really from day one.
All right. So you mentioned a couple of things that I want to dive into. One is a possibility of violence. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the degree to which Republican legislators are tolerating or pushing back against his, not sure what to call it, campaign of lies. Quinta, you are our resident student of Republican senatorial toleration of Donald Trump. Are you as unimpressed as Susan is at the degree of pushback? Or do you think there's been more substantial and firmer response to Trump than Susan gives Republicans credit for here?
I think I would largely agree with how Susan has characterized it. I would put the Republican response into three buckets. So the first bucket is people who have, as Susan said, kind of put out these sort of mealy-mouthed statements, kind of condemning, not being really explicit about it, being a little cutesy. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, for example, put out a tweet saying that, you know, every legal vote should be counted. When he was asked about it by reporters, asked about Trump's claims, he said, "See my tweet." I think a lot of people are leaning on this point about legal votes because that sort of seems to acknowledge the president's claims that some of the votes are illegal without actually saying anything technically wrong. So they're sort of trying to really walk a fine line here. It reminds me a lot of how Republican leadership handled, say, instances where it looked like Trump was going to fire Robert Mueller, right? Where they would sort of make these vague intonations that, you know, it might be bad if he did that and sort of hope that he backed off. So that's the first bucket. And I think it is definitely the biggest bucket. So the second bucket is people who have, to one extent or another, sort of cast their lot in with Trump. I think that ranges from, as Susan said, Lindsey Graham, who has really been out there, went on Fox, said that, you know, this is a quote, "Philadelphia elections are as crooked as a snake." I don't know what that means, but seems to suggest that Trump is right in his claims that the election is somehow being stolen. There are also senators like Ted Cruz, who has, you know, sort of voiced support for this idea that election observers need to be able to watch the count very closely, physically closely, without outright saying that the election is being stolen. This group also includes folks like, obviously, Trump's children, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, who have been really aggressive in their rhetoric. And then there's a third group of people who have outright condemned what's going on. That includes, most notably, I think, Mitt Romney, who put out a statement saying that Trump was wrong to say that the election was rigged, corrupt, and stolen. It also, interestingly, includes some former Republican officials. So Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, said that Trump was wrong to make that argument. And of all people, Rick Santorum, the former senator from Pennsylvania, very shortly after Trump gave his sort of bizarre press conference where he put forth all of these lies on Thursday night, Rick Santorum was on CNN saying that Trump's comments were dangerous and shocking and that other Republicans should condemn them. So I think there's a pretty broad range of responses, as you see. It will be very interesting, I think, to see how Republicans change or don't change their postures as they sort of see which way the wind is blowing over the coming days.
All right, let's talk about violence. Jacob, in the run-up to the election, there was a lot of anxiety about Election Day violence. There doesn't seem to have been a lot of Election Day violence, though there were some intimidation efforts. How do you see the prospect of violence in the post-election period, with the caveat, of course, that if there was any violence over the weekend, we didn't know about it because we recorded this on Friday?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said is right, that there was this real fear before the election, and I think a very legitimate fear. So it's been a year with record gun sales, a lot of far-right attacks, and also a year in which the president has made very explicit insinuations that his supporters should come watch the polls. So I think, first of all, like it wasn't an overreaction to be concerned about Election Day violence, but I think now, at least from my perspective, the danger is even greater, right? So as the math gets more and more bleak for Trump, as it becomes increasingly clear that he's not going to be able to pull this out, I think there's going to be an uptick in desperation among his most fervent supporters. And you can already see this, particularly on social media. So there was a big Facebook group called Stop the Steal, which became one of the fastest growing Facebook groups in the platform's history. And it gathered an enormous amount of people, hundreds of thousands of people in the group, sharing misinformation about discrete instances of what they perceived to be voter fraud, and sort of rallying together to like a call to action to go to these polling places and to interfere and to monitor, as they would say, the election counts. And I think that that's the type of thing that makes me the most nervous, because it seems like whereas very few people actually took Trump up on his request to watch the polls as the voting was happening, there was these discrete instances of guys dressed in military fatigues who would show up at polling places and not leave and then get arrested by local authorities for just trespassing charges. Whereas that was the case on Election Day, it's increasingly becoming clear that there are people who, for whatever reason, are showing up literally to the places where the ballots are being counted and, you know, banging on the doors of the Philadelphia Convention Center or in Detroit. And then last night, To make things worse, Alex Jones, who's the famous right-wing conspiracy theorist, made an appearance at a Maricopa County election office to lead the charge with a megaphone to stop the steal and to make sure that, you know, Trump had won the election. And I think, obviously, those things in and of themselves haven't translated yet to people being hurt, but there's a certain energy in the air that they create that it makes me nervous. And I think I think for at least me, my eyes will increasingly be on the platforms, so on Twitter and on Facebook, but also on more fringe right-wing platforms like Gab and even sort of the Wild West of mainstream platforms like YouTube, to try and see how these companies deal with what I fear will be increasingly overt calls for action.
Quinta, do you agree with that? Do you think we have, this is a situation where the violent moment has passed, or just that a flashpoint moment has passed and there's 100 others in the immediate pipeline?
I think it's the latter. I don't know about 100 others, but I agree with Jacob. I think, look, Election Day could have been very bad and it wasn't, and that is an unambiguously good thing. I do worry, as we've said ad nauseum, we're recording this on Friday afternoon. The election has not yet been called. I worry that the longer the networks wait to call it for Biden, the longer this period of uncertainty stretches out, the more time there is for sort of disinformation and misinformation to take hold and possibly spark outbreaks of violence as people, you know, bang on doors to look at people counting votes and all that kind of stuff. I understand why the networks have waited this long. They, you know, it's a weird election with all the mail-in ballots. They want to get it right. I have been wondering about that as these past couple days have dragged on. I also think it is going to be really, really important how right-wing media covers these next few days. There's some indication that talk radio hosts have been suggesting that, you know, the Democrats have stolen it. Fox is sort of in the middle of like a what Ben Smith of the New York Times described as a family argument right now in terms of whether or not whoever happens to be on the air at any given minute is saying that Biden won or that, you know, the election was stolen. If there is credence given in the right-wing media ecosystem to this idea that the election is being stolen, I think that could potentially be extremely dangerous. And Fox, in my mind, is going to be the thing that I'm really going to be watching to see how they handle what's coming, and that may be a bellwether for what we should expect.
Susan, what do you think? One of the striking things about the last few weeks is the number of plots that have been disrupted in Michigan and Pennsylvania. Is this a situation in which actually conventional law enforcement is being quite effective?
I don't know, right? So this is an environment in which it's really difficult to know. You need to have 100% rate of success. And so the fact that law enforcement has identified and prevented at least a number of efforts at violence or incitement to violence thus far, you know, doesn't mean they'll be able to prevent the next one. And that's why sort of caution around the rhetoric here is incredibly important. And instead of seeing establishment Republicans attempt to be responsible and to tamp this down, they're actually fanning the flames at this point. There's new reports now that other Republican candidates, including the Republican candidate for Senate in Michigan, are now also refusing to concede their races and are also baselessly claiming voter fraud. And so actually it's sort of this claim, these really, really clearly false claims by the president, are catching on and are spreading spreading. You know, that is sort of the recipe for the kind of civil unrest that leads to somebody being hurt. You know, we can certainly hope and pray that that doesn't come to pass, and maybe we will get lucky and it won't. But it's certainly not a comfortable position to be relying on the competence and lack of failure rate among state and federal law enforcement to prevent an event like this. And rather than seeing rhetoric getting less inflammatory, we're seeing it get more inflammatory right now. We have the House Minority Leader talking about there being a battle. You know, we're not out of this battle yet. And the president's son is talking about a war. Right, this is really, really dangerous stuff, and it's difficult to predict exactly what will happen. But certainly, if there is some sort of episode of violence, nobody can claim to be surprised by it, which is why it's frankly just appalling that we're in this situation. I do agree with Quinta. You know, on one hand, I respect sort of the institutional standards of various decision desks that have chosen not to call until very sort of specific data standards are met. But the longer that the race remains uncalled, the greater the sort of possibility of violence. And I think we're really seeing, as the election sort of draws out and as the time period extends, things are getting worse, not better. I mean, it literally sort of on a by the hour basis at this point. And so it is a little bit troubling and perplexing that in this environment in which there are real costs and consequences for sort of refusing for AP and Fox News and the major networks to refuse to make a call that every single sort of reasonable person, including Republicans, agree is absolutely inevitable at this point. You know, so I hope that we listen to this, you know, on Monday and in the days ahead, and it all seems very, very overwrought because nothing came to pass and it was all just a bunch of talk. But if that's not the case, I don't think anybody should be surprised.
All right, let's talk about the transition. I assume that if one has not been made by the time this podcast runs, very shortly thereafter, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, there will be a series of announcements about the transition. Jacob, what do we know about the Biden transition?
Yeah, so most of the reporting about the Biden transition relatively long predates the election. So the newest things that we've learned is that on Wednesday, I think it was Wednesday early afternoon, the day after the election, the Biden campaign actually created a transition website that everyone can look at. It doesn't have a ton on it as of now, but...
And when you say it doesn't have a ton on it, it doesn't have anything on it. Is that right?
The last time I checked, it is a slogan, I believe. And a photograph
and nothing else. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So when Jacob says doesn't have a ton, what he means is it doesn't have anything.
Yes, that is correct. So I'll start with the things that we knew before the election. So it's been reported for a while that Ted Kaufman, who briefly was a senator from Delaware and is a longtime Biden advisor, is the person who's leading the transition effort overall. And the most Lawfare relevant transition personnel figure is Avril Haines, who used to be the deputy national security advisor. There's been reporting that suggests that she's leading the Biden transition's foreign policy and national security team. And then this week, I would say the biggest transition related story was a piece in Politico that described that Biden is a COVID task force as part of his transition team. So, you know, the Biden campaign had really made COVID preparedness and COVID response a big part of their campaign and of the appeal of Joe Biden. And they, at least if this reporting is true, have backed that up by creating a task force of various experts, the most high profile of whom is probably Vivek Murthy, who was the former Surgeon General. So it seems like, at least from the public reporting, that COVID, as we would all expect, is going to be a huge part of this transition. And I would add that, like, you know, any transition is challenging and is a big deal, but it's an immensely bigger deal as it's happening with the backdrop of a pandemic that on election day infected 1,000 Americans.
Scott, one of the things about transitions that are odd is how much more they obsess Washingtonians than everybody else put together. What do you expect from the Biden transition? If I were running this transition, it would be an incredibly hard job because I think you can't expect cooperation from the incumbent administration, at least not above the career level. And you have to be at least a little concerned about active undermining of the transition. How should we think about the task of this transition as different from other transitions?
Sure. It is definitely a difficult situation. And it depends a little bit, I think, on how the Trump administration views and greets the potential transition and to the extent to which the Trump administration is conceding to reality that they've lost this race, which at this point they are certainly not doing, but perhaps they'll come around in the coming days and weeks. If they do, then the incoming Biden administration hopefully will be in a good position to engage. But that seems fairly unlikely. What they may have to do is make it easier for the Trump administration to allow certain levels of cooperation by not playing up the difference between what they're doing as a full transition, acknowledging that, yeah, okay, there may be still legal proceedings going on. Maybe there is still recounts going on, but we're still going to hopefully be certified as the apparent elector by the General Services Administration who makes that determination and then kind of kicks off the more formal transition process. And so that may entail actually not rolling out right off the bat with a long string of appointments. It might entail downplaying the larger announcements, the things that very clearly will be perceived by Trump as a shot across the bow to say, I'm the new incoming president, you have lost. And instead trying to get cooperation at a much more working level, which frankly is more valuable at this point. That's where you're going to get actually information out is where you're going to actually get the coordination and connections you want. The high level appointments, to the extent they're even involved in the transition, probably are not going to be the people in the agencies at this point. They're going to be getting ready for their confirmation hearings in late January, once after the transition happens and after the inauguration. And so that's something that can happen without a formal announcement, without really playing it up. So I don't know how they're going to play this. It really is going to be a little bit of a judgment call and a gut call about the best way to play the situation, the best way to see the extent to which you can actually maybe be able to get people within the Trump administration to cooperate a little bit more, even if President Trump himself is kind of withholding his own personal cooperation, the degree to which he blocks and actively obstructs other people's efforts in the administration to go along with the transition will depend a little bit upon that relationship. And they may want to tread carefully for that reason. But this year is just different. So it's hard to know for certain. Eventually, you are going to get what are often called landing parties in the individual agencies. This is where you're going to see more, usually fairly reasonably working level people, but mid-level people going into the agencies, beginning to sit in offices, get the documents, get the downloads, begin to understand the agencies and prepare the ground for political appointees to come in on January 20th. You know, hopefully before then, you'll also see an apparatus set up that kind of parallels the National Security Council, parallels some of the White House bodies that, again, will step into that body. The big advantage the Biden administration is going to have is that a lot of the people who were in the Biden administration were working in the White House and in the Obama administration just 4 years ago. 4 years is just enough time that will not have had a complete turnover in staff in a lot of these offices. A lot of the people involved at the agency level or career people are going to be a lot of familiar faces and have relationships with some of the incoming Biden people, a lot of the incoming Biden people. A lot of the incoming Biden people also started as civil servants, particularly on the national security side. And Avril Haines was a lawyer at the Office of Legal Advisor at the State Department, which is an office I'm also an alumni of, to start her government career. A number of other people started as civil servants and then eventually transitioned over onto the political side. And a lot of people are going to be coming back. There are also a lot of civil servants who left the government over the last 4 years over objections to the Trump administration who want to come back in. I wouldn't be surprised if you see a lot of them on the transition team precisely because they're going to have the familiarity with the agency and the agency work that you want to facilitate a clean transition, particularly where you may be facing unique obstacles that you wouldn't have faced in other years. So they do have that edge. And so I expect that they're going to do as good a job as you can expect going in, again, because they have this institutional memory and experience alongside them. But it really is going to be a tricky situation. And a lot of it is going to depend on the degree to which President Trump is personally involved and the degree to which he is allowing the agencies to kind of go about their business and not actively being an obstacle. So there's a lot of relationship maintenance that's going to be involved.
Susan, what do you think? I mean, I cannot imagine President Trump playing anything other than an extremely counterproductive role over the next 75 days. How do you run a transition in the face of the active efforts of the sitting president to frustrate it? Do you have any tips for Avril Haines?
I think you see what you can do outside the White House, and you can probably do 80% sort of without the involvement of the White House. There are statutes that govern this, and you send your DOD team to the Pentagon and people meet with them and right officials, career officials who are going to be there afterwards. I think you attempt to sort of execute that, in good faith with the officials that are there. The problem is that remaining 20% that absolutely requires the involvement of the president, the sitting president, and his closest advisors is really, really, really important stuff. And at the end of the day, all they can do, I think, is hope that decisive electoral calls, a decisive victory in court, will be enough to sort of shift the political momentum to the extent that establishment Republicans feel the need to sort of push back. You know, one thing that they could make sort of a serious issue is, it does look like these two Senate races in Georgia are going to determine control of the Senate. That means that that Mitch McConnell cares about sort of perceptions of what the Republican Party is doing, what it is tolerating. I think you have to just hope that, there is enough sort of accountability. I also think it's going to be pretty obvious exactly what's going on here, the petulance of all of this. I think there's also a possibility that at some point Trump himself will be isolated and ignored, that we'll essentially see Mike Pence step in, effectively run the transition, or that sort of the sort of Trump staffers in the White House right now will basically just ignore him, and start going about doing the work of a transition. That said, look, the Trump team came in and they didn't do much work to communicate with the transition team. They had no idea what they were doing. Key positions went unstaffed. And then the one benefit that Biden administration will have on day one is going to be, well, we don't know the identity of every single person, that we can bet that's going to be a really, really experienced team. It's not going to be a group of people, even like the first days of the Obama administration that was kind of figuring out which end was up as sort of every new administration does to some degree. Biden is really seasoned. This isn't 12 years or 16 years since he was last in office. He was there 4 years ago. He knows where the copy paper is still. And his team knows it too. I think what we have to hope is sort of cooler heads prevail and they're able to do enough to not sort of create catastrophic consequences. And then that the advantage that they'll enter, sort of the ability to govern, the familiarity with processes and procedures, the ability to use the engineering term, to return to the last known good state, which was January 20th, 2017 at 11:59, and sort of reset from there. I think we have to hope that that advantage, helps sort of make up some of the gap that Donald Trump is intentionally creating at this point.
Quinta, I'm going to give you the last word. One of the things that seems to be not on the table in the context of this transition, because of the nature of the election result, which is to say somewhat mixed, right? Congressional Republicans maintained a certain amount of power. Mitch McConnell is very likely, though not certain, to be a majority leader again. We are, I think, as a result of that, unlikely to see the kind of accountability effort that people, including you, have argued was going to be necessary. I don't think we're likely to see the sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission that you've been talking about. How do you understand, the task of accountability in the face of an electoral result of this kind? I mean, we kind of want to get around our hands around what happened and its sort of assault on our democratic institutions. But we're also going to have to be talking in doing so to people who we have to sit across the table from and do business to get anything done. How do you do that?
It's a great question, and one that I've been thinking about a lot over the last few days. Yeah, I think that, look, in a perfect world, if there had been a total blowout, right, with Democratic control of Congress, Senate, I would have argued, as you've mentioned, Ben, have been talking about this for a while, would have argued for some kind of coordinated effort to come to terms culturally and legally with everything that was done during the Trump administration. So you mentioned a truth commission. I think that's one model. Call it lustration, right? Whatever you want. I do think that there is just not that possibility in the way that I would have liked to see right now. It's just not realistic. So as you say, that leads us with this question of what the hell do we do now? I would argue that part of the process is going to involve norm setting by the incoming administration, I would hope, about, you know, what precedents they're going to stick with from the previous administration, what kind of people they're going to work with. I think that it is also frankly, a cultural matter. I don't want to, you know, I'm not calling for people to be thrown out of restaurants or anything like that, but I do think that we are collectively going to need to think very carefully about what the line is in terms of who we are willing to work with, you know, who we're willing to hire, who we're willing to sit across a table with, what kinds of actions under this administration are forgivable, or at least forgivable for the time being, and what are so far beyond the pale that a line needs to be drawn. I don't think that's going to be a particularly pleasant process. I do think it needs to be done. And I think there are going to be a lot of hard questions that it raises about what the trade-offs are between that kind of line drawing and the sort of normal political horse trading that takes place, which is going to be all the more difficult depending on what direction the Republican Party takes in the years to come. So this is a really long-winded way of saying I really don't know, but I hope that it is something that the incoming administration and the sort of, you know, political commentariat as a whole are thinking about very seriously.
We're going to leave it there. Quinta Jurecic, Scott Anderson, Jacob Schultz, Susan Hennessy, thank you all so much for joining us. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of the esteemed firm of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, so tweet about it, share us on Facebook, you know, upvote us on Reddit and pin us on Pinterest, make YouTube videos about us. You know, it's the Wild West of mainstream social media. Use it. Promote Lawfare. You can get our merch at thelawfarestore.com. You should leave a rating and review wherever you found us. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.